Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. I am honored and privileged to be with Chris Hurst today. Chris is a keyboard player. He's currently living in Nashville. He's played with Josh Turner, Florida Georgia Line, Zach Williams from the Lone Bellows, the Swan Brothers, those are the guys that are finalists on The Voice, and loads of other artists out of Nashville. He's played at the famous Ryman Auditorium, and he's been the opening act for major artists like Brad Paisley, Brantley Gilbert, and Dierks Bentley, just to name a few. He's currently touring with and playing keyboards and singing backup vocals in Kelly Pickler's band about 100 nights a year. And he's got a number of side projects going, including the indie pop band Neon Ninjas. And he doesn't know this, but he is breaking my cherry because he is the first keyboard player I have interviewed. Chris, thank you for breaking my cherry, and thank you for being with me on the show.
No problem. My specialty is breaking cherries.
Well, you are very gentle, so I appreciate it. Hey, man, you got a lot of stuff going on. What are you working on now that you're most excited about?
You know what's funny is to hear you say what I do, it makes me – I go, wow, this is an exciting person you're describing. And then I'm like, oh, wait, it's me. It sounds a lot better than I feel like my reality is. But I would say the thing I'm working on now I'm most excited about is I would say – my songwriting. I'm a songwriter, and I don't know what the future is going to hold, but I have sort of some irons in the fire and some things that are coming up that I'm really excited about around songwriting. So,
are you doing? Is that some of those independent projects that you had shown me? Those are your songs, most of them?
Okay, so to give you an example, tomorrow I'm tracking gang vocals on a song I wrote with an artist. Her name is April Cry, and we wrote a song called If Girls Ruled the World. And fingers crossed, I've been told this song will be on Radio Disney Country.
Oh my, awesome, man.
Yeah. So we're tracking it. A guy named Brad Hill's producing it. Me and Kyle May actually wrote the song with her. I think you've had Kyle.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I had this idea called If Girls Ruled the World. I brought it to her, and she loved it, and it sort of sparked this creative partnership between me and her. And so we're going to keep writing, and but it's going to be her next single, actually, I was told.
It's going to be her next single.
That's correct, yeah.
That's fantastic, man. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
So are you – when you write a song,
yes,
are you networked enough now that you know artists – directly that you could say, hey, I wrote this, is this a fit for you?
Or well,
how do you get it, your songs okay distributed?
With her, I played for her, and so I got to know her that way. Now, as far as, like, for instance, pitching or plugging songs to artists that I play for, that is a big no-no. That's just not the kind of relationship that I have with, say, a Josh Turner or, you know, or Kelly. I mean, it's two different worlds that you kind of got to work.
Interesting.
And maybe they'll coincide one day, but as far as my life has panned out so far, they don't. You know, so you really got to be careful about that. When I'm out on the road with an artist, I'm not there to plug my songs or push my agenda. I'm on their time, you know.
Interesting.
My role is keyboard player. That's what I do, you know. So you got to be real careful about that.
So as you write more songs, though, how do you get them out?
Well, just from years of writing songs, I don't know. There's a couple publishers that plug my stuff. I don't know. I mean, it's so funny getting my songs in the right places. Never have I tried less to do that, yet never has it happened more for me. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. And that
it's almost like when the focus is getting the songs out there, I don't know, you're taken away from creative fire, and people get warm by creative fire, you know.
No, that
they
makes
say,
a ton
yo,
of sense.
I gotta get warm by that, you know. That's sort of the way I look at it.
That's awesome, man. I hope, fingers crossed, man. I hope you know, we'll stay in touch. You let me know. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a great song. It, you know, it has an outlet, and I think it's a cool message. It's a cool, like, pop country message for, like, what's been going on right now in the world. You know, I think there's a big message for, like, women empowerment. And I was on a run one day. I don't know, man. I just got the title in my head, If Girls Ruled the World. And I was like, yo, there's three rhymes in that, I think. You know? So I was like, that's a good title. And so – but I was like – I was praying, and I was like, I don't know who to take this to. You know, I need to write this with the right person because I know it's good. And then this opportunity came up to write with April. And we wrote the song, and she loved it. And she said, you know, sort of my attitude. She goes, I want to make this my next single. And so I was like, okay, sure, you know. And then I'll believe it when I hear it. She goes, I'm sending it to Brad Hill. And I was like, sure, I'll believe it when I see it. And then I was tracking. I was recording at another studio, and I was sent a video saying, hey, we're tracking this right now.
Awesome.
And so it was weird to be at another studio tracking on somebody's songs while a different keyboard player is tracking on my song. It was a weird experience.
How did that feel?
It just kind of felt like I have, you know, you write the, I felt the, my first experience of like, you write these things and really you have no control over what happens to them, you know.
But so, were you excited, or did you feel like, you know, hey, I should be doing the keyboards on that?
I was excited, and I thought, as long as the keyboard player that plays on it is better than me, I'm cool with it. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure the guy I know of the guy that played on it, and I'm pretty sure he could smoke me on a keyboard. So my ego has been satisfied.
Well, that's good, man. Well, congratulations. Yeah. Is there a place online people can listen to that yet?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, it's sort of like in the birthing stages. So I know that April Cry, KRY, I think it's pretty soon you should find it under her name.
Somewhere. Awesome. And it's called If Girls Ruled the World.
If Girls Ruled the World. Yeah. Big explosive song.
That's actually a great, I mean, you could see a video, all kind, you know, tons of creative ideas would come up for a video for that.
I was told that there is a possibility that me and Kyle May will be dressing as women for the music video. But there is no guarantee, and I just want to say on record that I would be willing to do that, you know.
Well, there you go. Hey, where are you originally from?
I'm from Nashville. I actually grew up in Nashville.
Oh, cool.
But all my family is from East Tennessee, and I was born in Kingsport, Tennessee. So I come from a Appalachian Mountain, East Tennessee family.
Cool. And no one's, like, brothers and sisters aren't married to each other in that lineage, no?
Well, my great-grandfather married his cousin.
That's close enough. As long as you're representing somehow.
Okay, let me just say on record, long before, what is it, Duck Dynasty and the Whites and all this, you know, came about, it's cool to be Southern, mm-hmm. You know? Like, I was trying to hide that aspect of my family, you know.
Interesting.
Like I had the family shame, you know, and now it's cool to be, you know, a hillbilly, I guess. But people don't really understand what that word means, you know. People say, you know, I have rednecks in my family, and I say, man, no, you don't, bro. You know? Your great-grandfather marries your cousin, you know, and your papaw cut the hitch off his double wide, you know, because he thought the government was going to take it, you know. Call me up. That's when you got rednecks in your family. You know what I'm saying?
So this is a good intro to my next question. What kind of childhood did you have?
Well, my childhood was – it was an interesting childhood. It wasn't – I wasn't part of the poverty that my parents experienced as – you know, an East Tennessee family. I mean, my mom grew up on dirt floors and didn't have a bathtub growing up, you know. Oh, wow. Kind of like had to use the outhouse kind of thing. So I didn't have that. I'm not going to pretend like, you know, I grew up in East Tennessee poverty. Mm. However, my childhood was chaotic, and, you know, I can definitely trace it back and say my parents were directly affected by that, and I was affected by the fact that they were affected by that, you know.
Sure, I get it. Did you have brothers and sisters? Any brothers or sisters?
I have one brother, yeah.
Older, is he in music industry as well?
No, he's a younger brother, and he, no, he's not in the music industry. So.
So I'm, what kind of, like, what kind of jobs did your folks have?
Okay, so my dad worked in IT.
That's awesome.
He's always been a computer guy. We've always had computers. It's probably why I hate them. Technology has always been in the house, and I'm just so resistant to it now. But that's what my dad did. And then my mom was mostly a stay-at-home mom, but when times got tough, she worked at a factory. She did a couple of other odd jobs. So.
Well, it's good. Sounds like your dad was able to kind of rise above.
Yeah, he was. I mean, my father didn't grow up in poverty. My dad grew up sort of in high society, Rogersville, Tennessee. We come from all my family comes from a town called Rogersville, Tennessee, and so he was sort of like high on that side of the family. They were all chemists and scientists, you know. So
that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
What was your earliest exposure to music that you can remember, and how did that lead you to start playing keyboards?
I remember at the age of, I want to say 4 or 5, my parents told me and my brother that we were going to play a musical instrument. And I think we chose, I don't remember what the options were, but we chose piano, me and Drew. Mm-hmm. Drew is my brother's name. We chose piano because it was so big, and we liked, you know, this big, massive instrument. We were sort of like amazed by it. And also, we grew up in the Southern Baptist Church, and the preacher, the pastor, played the piano, and he also gave piano lessons. So all that kind of like came together where we're playing piano. So we started taking, me and Drew started taking lessons together.
Did you have a piano? Did your parents have a piano?
I remember my parents, we went and we did a rent-to-own piano. It was cherry red. And they went and got a rent-to-own piano, put it in the house, started taking piano lessons, and we were mandated to play for 30 minutes a day. They made us practice for half an hour a day.
It's pretty reasonable.
Yeah, I guess. For a little kid, yeah.
What prompted them to just like come home and say, hey, you guys are going to play an instrument, like, as opposed to you're going to start in, you know, t-ball or whatever?
Well, we did play baseball and all that, and but I just remember, I don't know, man, you know, the only memory I have is just sitting in our minivan talking about it, and I can't tell you what. I mean, I may have to ask my dad that the next time I see him, but I can't really remember exactly what spawned the conversation, but I just remember sitting in the van talking about playing the piano.
Yeah, that's really curious.
Yeah.
Okay, so you start playing piano 4 or 5, you start taking lessons, the preacher's giving you lessons. Where did that go from there? For you,
well,
anyway.
For me, you know, went to, you know, we were playing offertories. That was sort of our recitals growing up. Mm-hmm. We moved to Nashville. I started taking lessons from the church organist. So basically, I would say, looking back on it, and you know, you don't realize things until you look back on it, but looking back on it, music was, you know, I grew up in a very chaotic family, so music was definitely an escape from that. Something and there was a deep spiritual tie to music too, you know.
Through the church?
Through church. I mean, I, you know, when I look back on it, I played offertories, I played the church, I played the special music. That was sort of my thing that I did, and I was terrible at performing as a young child. But it was something I did. So I look back and I'm like, this is something I've been doing that's very like inner childlike, so to speak.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there's a spiritual element to it too, you know.
Do you still feel, as an adult many years later, do you still feel that spiritual connection when you're playing or creating?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I would say that's probably the deeper draw to it, you know. It's sort of like no matter how bad life gets, I can still go play this gig and play music, and for that amount of time, I'm escaping. Like, I'm doing this thing I know I can do, you know.
That's great. That's fun. I think that music is like that for loads of people. I mean, I know I'm certainly not even close to a professional guitar player, but I practice every day, and for the 30 to 60 minutes that I play, I always walk away much more like zen at the end of it than in the beginning, you know, no matter, even if I'm having a good day, it's like, you know, that's always a tremendous, you know, a high return on that investment of time for me. So I understand exactly how you feel.
Yeah.
So you're playing all this. At what point in time did you say, you know, I'd like to do this professionally, or I'd like to continue on with this?
Well, I wouldn't say there was a time in like my childhood or being a teenager that I could say, yo, I want to do this for a job, because I didn't really have the ability at the time to formulate like a dream, so to speak, because of the way I grew up. So I think to get to this point in my life where I play professionally, I was sort of led on a path, a really rocky one, but I was led on a path. So when I graduated high school, I went to Belmont in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Belmont because every other school that I was that I applied to rejected me. So I was like, oh shit, what do I do now?
That's weird, because Belmont is like one of the most strict schools to get into.
I mean, I guess. I don't know. That's the one I was like, oh crap, what do I do? And it was like, my friends were going to Belmont, and I was like, I'll go there. A couple of my friends were going to Belmont, I'll go there. And I ended up going to Belmont and hanging out with these people. I knew that I loved music. I knew that I loved playing the piano. I fell in love with playing the piano, and there's a specific song. Stan Getz, who plays saxophone,
I know Stan Getz.
Right.
He used to play a song. Tenor.
Yeah. So he did a song with a piano player named Kenny Barron called People Time, right? And he did it in this cafe in, I think, Switzerland. And when you listen to the recording, you can hear the plates clinking in the background and the people in the back. And I think he died 6 months later from lung cancer, and you can hear him kind of gasping for breath.
Oh, wow.
But for some reason, I can still listen to that song today and tear up, because for some reason, that song, I said to myself, I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to sound like that guy playing piano. You know? So, you know, I would go on – I'm a runner, and a lot of my ideas and a lot of my inspiration comes when I'm running. I think I'm just kind of working my conscious mind so my subconscious can just kind of play. But I remember going on these long runs at night in Fairview, Tennessee, which is right outside of Nashville where we lived, and kind of looking up at the stars and listening to this song and just falling in love with this sound and being obsessed with the sound of a piano and the way he was making it sound.
That's awesome.
So that's all I knew going into Belmont. And then I went to Belmont, and these guys were saying, yo, I want to play for a living. I want to write songs for a living. And I was like, I didn't know that you could, like, do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Belmont. I took lessons. And by my senior year, I told my advisor, yo, I'm not doing this business thing. Like, I got a business degree, but I was like, I'm not doing this. I want to play piano. And he said, you're crazy. You know, he said he could get me a free doctorate in economics, you know, and I said, oh, I'm going to go play piano, you know, and he sort of wrung his hands of me. He was like, just go do it. Okay. You know, so that was sort of how I found my way into falling in love with music.
Through that Kenny Barron piano. I just pulled that up here. I'm going to make sure I listen to that after our call.
Yeah.
You know, it's
yeah.
interesting. You said a couple of things, and maybe this is why we kind of connect. I had a pretty troubled childhood as well, and I never ever dreamed of anything except getting the fuck out of there.
Yeah, I mean,
it was so I totally understand, you know, I was just, you know, survival mode every day, and you know, there was no, I didn't have the knowledge that you could have a dream to plan for something. That would have been someone speaking a foreign language to me. I just wouldn't have conceptualized that.
Yeah, man, that's not what we did. We survived.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I totally get that, and I think I tend to have a lot of creative ideas come to me. Same. I don't run, but I work out, and it's when your mind is disengaged, when your conscious mind is disengaged and your subconscious is let to roam free, that's when it comes out. Like for me, like when I'm in the shower, I'm at the gym, I'm sleeping and I wake up and I, you know, send myself an email or write a note on the side of the bed. So I totally get that.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you see, like, what is something you want to do more of moving forward, and where do you like to be music-wise over the next few years, and maybe even longer term if you do have a vision for that?
I mean, I would say, first of all, I would say anytime I have a vision, it always pans out differently than what I expected. But I would say there has been power in a vision, in that I'm living in something that I kind of thought up, you know? But I would say, I guess if I was to think up something, I would be writing songs, I would be producing songs, I would be working with creative dudes in the studio, I would be... I don't know that I ever really want to give up playing for some sort of artist, you know? I like... Now going out on the road and getting on a bus is sort of like a break from Nashville. Like, I'm about to go out. Let's see, I leave tomorrow at midnight with Kelly for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to it because I'm going to take my road bike and I'm going to, you know, get up every day and try to get a road bike ride in or get a run in and, you know, play on a stage and, you know, get paid to just kind of go hang out with friends on a bus and play music. You know, sort of like a break from the stresses of Nashville.
Interesting. So you'd like to be doing longer term, more production work, more writing, more on the brain creative side as opposed to exclusively relying on the keyboards.
Yeah. But I don't know that I ever want to give that up, you know, the keyboard playing. But you never know, man. I may wake up one day and say, fuck it, I'm done. You know, who knows?
Do you find, like, I exercise regularly too, as I mentioned, and I find that the payoff of that is so massive in ways that I, while I'm exercising, I don't expect. Do you kind of find that similar thing?
You know, I have to do it. It's so funny. Music and exercise, now when I think about that, are such a big, they kind of go together for me.
Well, there's a rhythm of both.
Yeah, there's a rhythm. When I'm out running, I'm listening to music, I'm coming up with ideas, I'm discovering new music. You know, it's something that I can't do. Like when I'm in the car, my brain is obsessing. But when I'm running, I'm sort of exercising and giving that overactive part of my brain a rhythm and something to do. So finally I can just,
shut down.
Shut down and just kind of listen and be inspired and feel things. You know.
No, I totally get that. I'm a lot older than you, so I will tell you that as you get older, that connection between – you will see the connection between the, you know, how much of a benefit the exercise has been in your life.
Yes.
Because you will see normal things for you are a tremendous burden for your peer group to do. Physical things, like walk,
yes,
simple things, you know, like,
yeah,
walking up a flight of stairs or something.
Yeah.
And just like the – you'll look – younger and than your peer group, and you know, I'll often be looking at Facebook, and I shouldn't say this, but it's true, and I'll see somebody that I knew as a kid, and I have to call my wife over and I'll say, baby, do I look this bad? Please.
Well, you know what was I play with Josh, the bass player, he was in his 60s, and his name is Joey Click. He's been around Nashville for a while, and he just retired and moved to Oklahoma to be with his grandkids.
Wow, cool.
And but he would get out there, we'd go ride 30 miles on our bike and then play a gig that night, you know.
Yeah.
And he could still do it in his 60s, I think, because he stayed in shape.
Yeah,
you know, he took care of his body, you know.
It's huge, man. As you get older, you, like I said, you come to realize that it is huge.
Yeah, you only get one.
Yeah, man, this is not a dress rehearsal for the next one, right? So you gotta, yeah. You know, I'm not interested in having, you know, the last 5 years of my life have 95% of my medical costs like everybody else.
No, that's terrible. Yeah.
Hell yeah. When you started playing professionally, what were some of the biggest surprises or things that you didn't know beforehand that you realized about the business aspect of music? Good, bad, or otherwise?
You know what? I had to do, I would say, I'll answer it like this. I had to develop sort of an intuition about what to do, what to follow and what not to follow, and to kind of trust my gut, you know. When I first – I guess my first quote-unquote professional gig, like I'm going to go out – I was working in corporate music because when I graduated college, I worked at a bakery, and then I worked in corporate music for a company called BMI.
Yeah, big company.
Yeah, and I worked with this guy named Mike Tatora, and he's sort of a second dad to me to this day. And I left that job to go play with a specific artist who shall remain nameless. And she's not famous or anything. But, you know, it was a terrible – it was a wonderful yet terrible experience at the same time because it was so tough. We were in a van. One time we vanned it from Seattle all the way to Nashville nonstop.
Oh, my God. You are kidding.
Yeah, this crazy ex-songwriter, you know, kind of managed her and drove us all over the damn country, you know, while she kind of flew home. You know, it was just – I don't know. I was kind of but like at that moment, I had this attitude of like, I've got to keep this gig. Like, I got to keep this gig. This is my shot. This is my chance.
Sure. That makes sense though.
But it got to the point where I was like, this is not worth it. This is ruining my life, and I quit the gig. But I think I needed that experience to teach me what is not worth it and to develop an intuition for bullshit. You know, like these are the things that people say when they're full of shit in this business, and these are the things that honest people say. You know, does that make sense?
That makes total sense. And I give you credit because that's a very hard I think it's very hard in any career when you're young to say – to fire your client in a sense.
Yeah.
And especially in a situation in the music business, which is so competitive, and it's not like that competition is like – invisible, but you know it's out there. It's literally right in your face 24/7, and especially in Nashville.
Yeah.
So really, I give you a lot of credit for coming to that realization at that point in time as a young kid. That is, you know,
I mean, it wasn't immediate the lesson that I learned. I think it took some years and some other life explosions to look back on that and be like, okay, that was my attitude about it at the time. And that led to this life explosion, this overall life belief. So it took some time to look back on that and be like, that was a terrible experience, yet it taught me a lot of lessons. Am I making sense at all?
Totally. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. It took a minute.
Yeah. But most things take a minute. I mean, it's not like, especially when you're young, man, the time doesn't drop like immediately. No.
Yeah.
And especially when you're young and you had no guidance. That is what makes it even much more
challenging. Yeah, I mean, I was figuring it out on my own.
Right, you know? Right.
And, you know, I think that looking back on it, I think some people graduated Belmont with sort of that level of self-esteem and wisdom that they were afforded that allowed them to get to places that I wanted to go sooner than I did. I had to take the long way around.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm the same. There's a quote I have somewhere, and it says it's far something like it's much better to break the chains and become free than to just be given freedom from day one. There's a feeling of sweetness in that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's kept the staying power with me is that it didn't – there's been some times I've almost quit. I mean, where I'm just like, this is not working. This is it. This is the time I quit. And then it's almost like I get one more little door open that just, okay, I'm going to walk through this little door that just keeps me from quitting.
Right.
Where, you know, it's, I don't know. It just kind of, it changes you. I don't know how to, you know, I don't know how else to say it.
So what did Mike Tatora, like what was his position at BMI? How did he like guide you or mentor you?
Well, Mike was the AVP of performing rights, and what ended up happening was I was playing at the time. I was playing with a band named, you may have heard of them. They're called Florida Georgia Line.
Yes.
But they weren't big at the time. These guys I'd known for years, and I actually played Tyler's first gig ever. I played at a bar called On the Rocks on Demumbrium here in Nashville, like before it was Douchebag. So now it's like total. I guess I shouldn't say it, but it's like now it's not. It used to be a lot more hip, I guess, as I remember it. And I used to play with this guy named Kanan Smith, who I guess he's famous now too. And I played Tyler's first gig ever. And at the time, we kind of reconnected later through playing church. And then I played with Florida Georgia Line at the time, like right before they got their record deal. And I was working at BMI at the same time. But I was sort of typecast as BMI guy. Like Chris just works at BMI, but he plays piano on the side. So I always knew I needed to, like, there's got to be a moment where I do this and this is all I do. And I just waited for years for it. Mm. And BMI, they were having layoffs. They knew we're having layoffs. And I asked the VP of BMI to lay me off. I said, Allison, can we choose to be laid off? I don't think any person has ever asked that woman if they could be laid off ever, probably. I would go ahead and challenge that. And layoff days came. Mike did a volunteer retirement. And he was sort of helping me out there at the end, where I would go out on the weekends and play with these artists, but he wouldn't tell anybody that I didn't show up on Friday.
Mm, okay.
No one knows that except me and him, but like,
and everybody, you know, listening to this.
Yeah, but like, he sort of helped me out. He sort of was like, okay, we'll just count you as here because I know you're gonna do this, and we'll see what happens on layoff day.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so layoff day comes, I don't get laid off. So I walk into my new boss's office and she's like, you know, I know you were Mike's guy. And I said, actually, she was like, you know, she was kind of wanted to talk about what it was going to be like to work for her. And I said, actually, this is the amount of vacation days I have. This is the amount of, like, these are the times I'm going to be out, and my last day will be this day. And she goes, okay, give me 30 minutes. I walk back to my desk. She calls me back up and she says, how about we pay you all those vacation days? We pay you up to that day. And we walk you out of the building right now.
Wow.
And I was like, what? She was like, you didn't do anything wrong. It's just legally we have to walk you out of the building. And so I literally said, wow, I just inadvertently negotiated myself a little severance.
Yeah.
So the money was deposited in my account, and I walked. I gave everybody a hug and walked out of the building. And that was the day that I became a professional, a full-time professional musician.
And you wanted to be laid off so it would force you to focus on your music career.
Because yeah, I was going to go play with the artists that banned me all across, you know, the continental United States.
Right, right. That's good, man. Yeah. I think it's good that you know you put yourself in the position where you had to do that. That was courageous and good.
Yes.
Who are your biggest influences music-wise and who are your favorite keyboard players?
I would say I love all types of music, and I know musicians always say that, but personally, even as a guy who writes pop country songs, you know, songs like If Girls Ruled the World, it's not like I'm listening to the country charts all the time. I find that a bit uninspiring because what am I going to do, write, you know, the derivative version of, you know, the latest song about a bar chick, you know,
right,
it's
right.
Like, I like to listen to a wider, you know, group of music. I think the guys that are really exciting me right now, I love this guy named Rag and Bone Man. He's from the UK. He's really exciting to me. I love listening to Amos Lee, one of my favorite artists. I dream about playing for him one day. If anybody's listening out there, I want to play for Amos Lee. Okay. I love Ray LaMontagne. I love anybody who has something cool to say.
Mm.
Yeah. Some of my favorite keyboard players. I want to say the guy probably that shaped my playing the most is a guy named Gordon Mote. He is the piano player for he plays for the Gaithers, but he's one of the top, you know, honky-tonk country players in Nashville.
Session guy?
Session dude, yeah. And he plays for the Bill Gaither Vocal Band.
Okay.
And it's interesting, like when I was at Puffy Muffin, that's the name of the bakery.
Muffin?
Yeah. I despised that job, man.
The Puffy Muffin.
It was terrible. His wife came in one day and someone said, "Hey, Chris, that's Gordon Mote's wife." And I said, "Hey, I love your husband. I love his playing." And she goes, "Oh, I'll bring him in." And I was sort of like, "Sure you are." The next day, Gordon Mote comes into the Puffy Muffin and visits me, and I talk with him. I meet with him. And then fast forward, you know, 3 to 4 years later, and I'm learning his parts note for note while playing with Josh Turner.
Wow.
You know, and my dad goes to church with him, and they talk about me and stuff. So it's kind of been interesting. I would say he's been a very influential keyboard player. Just learning his parts and having to learn his parts shaped my playing, and particularly my left hand on a keyboard.
Very. You know what? I mentioned to you, I interviewed Jerry McPherson, and he had the exact same story. He was going on tour with, I think, Vince Gill, and he had to learn all of the guy named Dan Huff's parts.
Yeah.
And he had the exact same story. He said that was such great tuition for him, and it shaped his playing for the rest of his career.
That's right, yeah. Having to learn the Josh Turner song All Over Me with that giant piano intro, you know, knowing that when they hired me, they fired another guy because he didn't learn it correctly. So I have to learn this
right. And
do it well. And to be honest, it took me a minute. I didn't kill it the first time, you know.
I think learning music, it's harder to retain it than learn it, in a sense. Because the only way you retain music, for me anyway, is by playing it 100 times.
Well, and I will say, like, when you have that experience of, like, I'm getting paid to do this, and this is the song right here that they let a guy go for. I got to go play this song, and I got to play it right. You're going to learn that song right, man.
Yeah.
You know what I'm
saying? If you got any, like, kind of work ethic anyway.
Yeah, if you know, when you got that going on, it's like you're going to learn this, and you're going to break through to another level, you know, and learn what that song is going to teach you. But I would say playing Gordon Mote parts, man, it taught me, like, the purpose of a piano in a studio. You know, when I'm recording now and I've played his parts and listened to his low parts, when it sounds like nothing's going on and hearing what he's doing and playing what he's doing, it's like, oh, okay, you're covering the mid-range in that way. You're doing this with your left hand. Got it, you know.
It's amazing the guys that are better musicians are always describing to me their thought process as a musician when they're actively playing, and much of their brain is occupied with listening to everything else in addition to themselves, but to just assimilating and putting everything into, like, one smooth, you know, musical piece. But it's just amazing how much attention, and you have to pay attention to all these other things.
Well, that's the idea, man, is that you get so good at your instrument that you don't have to think about it. So you're listening to the band. You're listening to what the guitar player is doing. You know, if during the chorus, you know, I look over and, you know, my buddy Tim is playing power chords, you know, or chucking, I'm going to blare a high organ on top of that, you know, because he's covering the low, I'm covering the high. You know,
mm-hmm.
So that's kind of, you know, the thought process. Yeah.
Anybody else that was an inspiration to you besides Gordon from a keyboard standpoint?
You know what, man? I'm just gonna leave it at Gordon. He's sort of the dude. Let's just give him credit where credit is due.
Good enough, man.
Yeah.
Are keyboard players gearheads like guitarists are?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's the same personally. I mean, you can geek out about anything,
right. But
there's sort of a standard, I would say, like, when you think about keyboard playing, there seems to be a standard sound that people expect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people want a good organ. In my genre, people want a good organ. And they want a great sounding piano, and they want a Rhodes or a Worley, you know. So however you get those sounds, you know, that's your meat and potatoes. I would say you can geek out on vintage keyboards, vintage synth sounds. But, you know, even now, like, you could buy soft synths where they simulate all those sounds, you know.
So you have all these different sounds and styles coming out of the same keyboard, basically.
Well, yeah, you do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not like you guys are buying pedals or, you know, you needed this and that, or you're using it's basically a modeler in your keyboard.
Well, I mean, I want to say on the keyboard that I use right now, you know, there is what a pedal would do. There are knobs on my keyboard to simulate that sound.
Mm.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So, but you can geek out and try and buy vintage, you know, Rolands and vintage, you know, Roland DSs or whatever it is that you're into to get, you know, vintage 80s sounds, you know. So, I mean, it's all about kind of what you're into.
Sure, totally get it.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say it's the same thing as guitars, because I listen to those dudes talk about amps and guitars, and I just think, dude, I got my sounds.
You probably think, thank God I don't have to deal with 10 pieces of equipment.
No, this is a pain. You're right, but like, there are some things. Like, I was in a session, you know, a couple weeks ago, and I was blaring the organ, and we had the Leslie going, and, you know, I don't know. You can geek out on where to put the mic, you know, or, you know, I kicked up the volume on the Leslie for one song because I wanted that crunch sound. I mean, yeah, but to me, as far as gear goes, I try and make it as simple as possible.
Cool.
You know, I find simplicity works best for me.
Hey, we're going to go into the part of the interview now. It's called Inside the Music Studio. That's some personal stuff to learn more about you.
Sure.
Are you outgoing or shy by nature?
I want to say shy, probably, in that I'm probably more of an introvert. I gather energy by being alone rather than being around people. I would say I am outgoing in that I like facing my fears, but I would say I'm probably more of an introverted person who at some times is not allowed afraid to speak his mind.
So do you find your business sort of allows you, like, I've interviewed a lot of musicians, and oftentimes when they are naturally shy, it's almost like not a split personality, but it's an alter ego.
Yes.
That it allows you to step out during that performance. Yeah, you're
that's
stepping
right,
out
yeah.
during that performance time where you're cutting loose, and that's kind of like a release. And then, you know, you kind of put that guy back in the suitcase and bring him out the next show, and then you go back to
that's
your
right.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I would even say that at times I experience like performance anxiety, where there's been times I've it's been time to take the solo or whatever, my hands just start shaking. I don't know why, you know, and it's just something I've had to deal with. But, you know, I would definitely say that probably shy, probably you know, as far as the business of music, you know, the idea of networking, the word just kind of makes me want to vomit. Yet, I'm sure that, you know, I don't know.
No, I totally get it. Like, building a relationship for a purpose other than the relationship kind of feels duplicitous.
Yeah, it's full of shit. I mean,
right.
I really realized that. I think I really started finding some success when I realized that something based on reality is going to last more than, you know, some me going and quote unquote hanging at an event and shaking hands and telling some dude how cool I am, rather than, like, you know, my buddy John plays guitar for Josh Turner. And that dude, like, when that guy called me, he called me because he knew I could play, but that guy sat with me at a sushi restaurant the day my ex-wife said she wanted to divorce me. You know, like, that guy knows the ins and outs of my life, and I know the ins and outs of his life. I've had hour-long conversations with him in the back of the bus talking about trying to date emotionally unavailable women. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, that is what my life is based on, real relationships, you know?
Yeah, and from those real relationships, other things come out of it. But
that's correct.
When you form a relationship simply for, like you said, hey, let me go to the party, or let me go to the event, and let's do some dick swinging and dick measuring.
Yeah, I'm sure that works for some people and they're good at it, but I'm not. So I'm just going to do it my way.
Yeah, I'm not either. That being said, I genuinely am curious, and I like good people.
Yes. Yeah. Sure.
And I will make a relationship with anybody that says, hey, you should meet this guy. He's a good guy. Great. I want to meet that person because he's a good guy. If something comes out of it, that's a mutually exclusive issue, but that's not my motive going into it. I can't do that either. I struggle with that, frankly.
Yeah.
You avoid social media. Do you mind if I ask you why?
Yeah, I find it funny. This is a thing with me, and it's become a thing in my life, where Chris is the guy that doesn't do social media, or he doesn't do social media. And I find that funny because it's even gotten to the point where four of my friends, all in the music business, have started a Twitter called Not Chris Hurst and put my quotes, because I guess I say stupid things, put my quotes on this thing.
But you know what, though, man? For example, Twitter, I have never I'm not a big social media. I have a Facebook page just so I could interact with my kids, my wife, and a couple of friends. But I'm not a big social media guy. But that's not about me. Why do you avoid it?
Man, I'll tell you this. Look, I'll draw this back to the theme of this entire interview, hopefully, has been there's a deeper meaning to my madness. And the reason I don't do social media is because I see it as this world where people are posting the highlights of their life, you know, and not showing their shadow side or their struggles. And so in such a jealousy-driven industry where that guy got this gig or that guy got this gig or I'm going to post this, this is me at my quote-unquote office today and it's some arena – and really, you're probably the opening act, and no one's really watching you. You know, and it's like as a fellow musician, I don't find it healthy or enriching to my spiritual life to be in a world where I go on there and I see this guy's highlight in his life, and I go, oh, well, because of that. That guy posted that, I then form an expectation on myself that I'm supposed to equal that guy because of so and so and so, you know, this reason and this reason and this reason. Therefore, I am less than that guy. Like, how is that attitude going to inspire creativity, inspire like the deeper fire within that really is going to keep you through the longevity of your career and really your life?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I want to live my life, not that guy's life. And I really see no – if someone wants to know what's going on in my life, why don't you call me and ask me?
Right. You know, it's interesting.
It's just not – I don't know, man. For me, this is just me. And a lot of people have said, oh, Chris, you're going to miss out on gigs. You're going to blah, blah, blah. You know, no, I'm not. I haven't yet, I don't think. You know, so – I don't know, man. That's just my take on it. That's the way it affects me. It's not everybody, you know.
I'll tell you something really interesting about that specifically. I listened to a podcast called The Hidden Brain. It's a 25-minute podcast. I think it's weekly by NPR.
Yeah.
And they just talk about stuff that goes on inside your brain, which I find very interesting. So there was an episode where – there's now a condition that people have developed exactly because of the reason you're saying, because everybody's posting these wonderful things on Facebook and they're feeling like, well, fuck, my marriage isn't that good. I'm not madly in love with my wife. I'm not going out to dinner every night. I don't eat food that fancy. And the problem is because there's no, you know, you don't see the other side of it. And frankly, you don't know if that side is even real. It causes people to get fucked up from it. And yes, they've done analysis into these things. And it turns out, which is, man, I always felt this way because it just seems like when you have to go so much over the top, it's not, you know. A guy once told me many years ago, I was hanging out with my buddy when I was probably 18 or 19 years old, and we ran into his dad, and I was just met him, I think, for the first time. We were talking, and he made a statement to me that's always stuck with me. And he said, Craig, a rich guy doesn't need to tell you how rich he is. A smart guy doesn't need to tell you how smart he is. And a good person doesn't need to tell you how good they are.
No.
And I really resonated with that because I think that the purity of life is that what it is. And when you start running that around, it tweaks that integrity of what you're saying you are. And it turns out that they've done these studies that the people that are putting the dinners on there every night, or, oh, I'm so in love with my spouse, they are really not accurate. You know, they probably don't have a good marriage. You know,
no, man, it's a fantasy world,
yeah,
to me. You know, yeah, it is. It's a big giant, you know, balloon full of air, and it could, you know, I don't know, man. It's just not. When I think about it, I just don't think of something real. I don't think of something deeper. I don't think of something meaningful. And the thing is that if you're like, let's make it about music, but I'm sure it goes for any really higher level endeavor that's going to be difficult for you, is that you're going to, if I continue to be a musician, songwriter, whatever, fill in the blank, and really want it bad, I'm going to experience a lot of rejection. I'm going to be told no, you know, and have experienced all this. Mm. So what's going to keep me going through it all? You know,
right,
what's going to keep that fire lit? And if I go on a social media website and I see that so-and-so's quote-unquote office is some arena, you know, that's just going to put water on my fire,
yeah,
on my passion. I want to put gasoline on my passion,
yeah, yeah,
not water, you know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense. Like,
yeah,
it's funny, my wife is a realtor, and when she first started, there's a woman that she knows that's a realtor, and she'd post, I've just got, I'm listing this house, and it was like a really nice house. And so she's, you know, and Ann would feel bad. And I said, babe, I don't know this for a fact, but you can research this. She's getting one or two at most houses a year like that. And that's why she's putting that on there. And it turns out 2 years later, that's exactly what's going on.
Yeah. And you know, man, it's like, you gotta, you know, to quote Jesus, I mean, you gotta build your house on a rock, not mm-hmm. sand.
Yeah.
You know, so that when the storms come, there's still something there,
mm-hmm.
you know. And image management for me, in which is, it's a weird thing you gotta do, because in music, it's a very image driven industry. And I'm not saying look like a slob on the stage.
Sure.
But I'm saying know what that is and know its purpose, you know.
Yeah, and, yeah. Know its place.
Know its place so that you yeah. have power over it. It doesn't have power over you.
I totally get you.
All this being said, you know, I'm acting like I'm some prophet against social media. I'm not. I'm a very broken individual. And so I'm not above having days or having moments or seasons in my life where I get obsessed with image, or, you know, I also don't want to send the message out there that I'm this, you know, high and mighty Puritan against all things not real. I mean, I'm a human being. So yeah, I see news articles about some guys that I was friends with that are now, you know, superstars. And do I feel jealousy and all that? Of course, you know. So I guess that's how I'd answer that.
Yeah, I don't, for whatever it's worth, I don't think you came across as like you're dogmatic. I think you're just sharing your viewpoint. So
yeah, I mean,
I don't think anybody's
yeah.
going to get that. You just seem like it's your viewpoint. And, you
yeah, know, sure.
Everybody's entitled to their viewpoint.
Yeah, it's just how I live my life. Yeah.
Hey, so Why country? You know, you like country, country pop. What about that genre made you gravitate towards it over another genre? Rock, classic rock, blues, and, you know, were there certain feelings that country and country pop evoke in you, or an outlet that others don't?
Well, you know, I think when I think back on it, you know, I always grew up in church, played church music, but I remember, like, I guess the first country song, like contemporary country song that I remember playing, and there's probably some other ones, but I was playing, I think it was my senior year of college, I played with a guy named Kanan Smith, and we played that bar called On the Rocks on Demumbrium. And he's the one that said, Chris, play these country songs for me. And we played, for some reason, the song that sticks out in my mind, you remember that Brooks and Dunn song, Play Something Country?
I don't, but I have no frame of reference in country. Oh, okay. So I apologize.
There's a lot of piano in that, and it sort of is the thing that was like, yo, I'm going to do this. I think I want to do this, you know. And I think living in Nashville sort of shaped my experience, my preferences.
Yeah,
you know, it's sort of what you do here, and you sort of work within that system. And also because, I mean, I grew up in the South. I grew up in East Tennessee. I was born in East Tennessee, and I grew up in Nashville. And, you know, I remember the first CD I owned was, I just remember a Christmas one time.
What was it?
My parents bought us Alan Jackson. What is the name of that album? Who I Am, I think is what it is. It had Summertime Blues on it and all those. And I remember we had a Reba McEntire album. And I want to say John Michael Montgomery. So that was my first CDs that I remember having. But, you know, I grew up, you know, we were a highly religious family. So I grew up listening to a lot of Christian music.
Right, right.
You know, my first bus gig was Sonic Flood. First time I ever got on a bus was a band called Sonic Flood.
Funny, man.
Yeah. So, I mean, lots of religious music, but I don't know. There was always country music. And just living in Nashville, I don't know, I fell in love with it.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
Do you have any, you said you run, any other hobbies or interests outside of music?
Yeah, I'm a downhill mountain biker. I mountain bike a lot. I just recently took a trip to Utah. I played a gig with Kelly in Park City, Utah. Me and my 60-year-old father, who's never downhill mountain biked in his life, went out and downhill mountain biked with me.
That's beautiful out there, man.
For 3 days, yeah. And I'm a road cyclist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So a road cyclist. I hit the gym a lot, read a lot. And I love my Labradoodle Charlie, who's laying right next to me. 70-pound Labradoodle. Sir Charles McDougall is what I call him.
Dude, you're probably the most well-rounded musician I've ever spoke to.
I know, man. I'm crazy.
Yeah, I've never heard. See that? No, I'll tell you what. You're not on fucking social media.
Yeah,
you're out mountain biking, road cycling, running, hitting the gym, and reading. And everybody else is looking on Facebook and seeing the fish tacos that their buddy had last night for dinner.
And don't get me wrong, man. I love fish tacos. The best favorite fish tacos in Nashville is Oscar's Taco Shop. Just for the record.
There you go. I'll have to go there when I come
over. Dude, they're the bomb, dude. They're better than all of them. I've had them all. But yeah, you're right. I guess I just, yeah, I like to live my life.
Yeah, I have literally, you are more diverse than any musician I've spoke to.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
What's the favorite place you've traveled?
It's not because I was on tour, but I want to say Florence, Italy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. One time I, in the Chianti area. I'm a wine collector too, by the way.
Oh, a xenophile. Yeah. Is that what they call that?
Yes, yes. So I collect wine, and I collect it with my buddy Mike, who I used to work for at BMI, and I had been
Tortora?
Tortora, Mike Tortora, yeah.
Oh, so he moved though, you said, right?
No, he still lives in
Nashville. He's still in town. Okay, cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, that's awesome.
Excuse me. We took a 2-week trip to Italy. I had been going through kind of a life explosion, and his wife of many years had just died of cancer.
I think
we both just needed to take a trip. And so we took a 2-week trip to Italy. And do I have a minute to tell a story?
Yeah, for sure. By all means.
So, we were in Florence, Italy, and we went to Siena, had this bottle of wine called Sergio Zingarelli. Mm-hmm. And we were the only ones in this restaurant. I think it was called something weird, like something stereotypically Italian, like Guido's or something. It seemed And we drank this bottle of wine. Mike picked it randomly. And we were the only ones in there, and there was pictures of Pavarotti had eaten there and Daniel Craig, you know, one of the James Bond films
yeah.
Siena. Yeah. And we're in at this restaurant. We're the only ones in there, and we drank this bottle of Chianti, this high-end Chianti, and it was fantastic. And the next day, I said, Mike, we got to go to this winery. It's Rocco Del Macchie, I believe is how you say it. And it was their highest grade of Chianti. So I put Rocco Del Macchie in the GPS. And we drive for a while. And before I know it, it takes me to a dirt road in the middle of Chianti in Tuscany where horses were roaming. And there were olive groves. And basically what the GPS did was it took me to the vineyard. So me and my buddy Mike, in a little Fiat 500, got lost in Tuscany on a dirt road where horses roamed. And eventually we found the winery and I brought back a case of the wine.
Very cool. And
a bottle of the wine of the vineyard that I got lost in. And we took a picture of the Fiat 500 after, you know, on this dirt road is covered in dust. You know, it was a really cool experience. I'll remember that the rest of my life.
Yeah, so you got good memories associated with the wine every time you drink it, too.
Oh, yeah.
That's very cool, man.
Yeah, yeah.
I meant to ask you, how was that experience with your dad going mountain biking down? What made him – did he come out to Utah specifically for that, or does he live in
Utah?
Yeah,
we went out there together. No, he lives in Nashville. Okay. You know, we went out there together, and, you know, man, he was bad at it, and he fell a lot. But, man, that old man kept getting up and getting back on that damn bike, and – I would say, Dad, do you want to go down again? He said, yeah, let's do it again. And I remember the third day we got lost – or not, we didn't get lost. We got stuck on the mountain because of a storm, and the guys working there made us go down a really, really hard trail. And I could tell he was scared because he was just talking away, just chattering. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Dad, are you scared? And he was like, no, I'm not scared. You know, I just tell you – you know, like, I'm scared, bro. It's okay. So we had to go all the way down this trail because the lift stopped because of the storm.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go like 100 feet in front of him and then wait on him, you know, because there would be some drop or some giant hill or something that I was like, he's going to kill himself on this. And then I remember at one point all I hear is, oh, no. And my dad fell off the trail and about 7 feet down into this rock gully and busted up his thumb and his thigh and his shoulder and stuff. But he got back on the bike and went all the way down, and the third day of mountain biking I did by myself because he was like, Chris, I think I'm done, man. I need to go to the doctor. He thought he broke his thumb, but he didn't. I just think he's not used to falling off a bike like I am, being tossed around. I tell you what, man, he got banged up. He probably fell 15 times. He kept getting back up, getting on the bike, and he will not shut up about it. You know, he's so proud of himself. You know, he's 60 years old. I was the oldest guy on that mountain, blah, 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 blah. But he's super proud of himself. So it was a good experience.
So was a good quality bonding time for you guys?
Sure, yeah.
Are you close with him?
Yeah, I'm close with my dad.
That's good, man. That's nice. This is a silly question, but for you it may not be. If you could be a superhero, which superhero would you be?
I mean, I know it's super cliche, but I mean, Superman, right? I mean, it's like the guy could do everything, you know. He can fly, whoop ass, laser eyes. I mean, I don't know. There's nothing the guy – it's such a cop-out.
Chicks dig him.
Yeah, chicks dig him. He's got like an ultra – he's got like a shy – alter ego, it's like, you know, he's the whole pack. He is the quintessential superhero. He is the quintessential male fantasy
there you go,
that we all aspire to be. But does James Bond count? Could that, I be James Bond?
James Bond is a badass. I would say yes, that counts.
Because I would say I was obsessed with James Bond. I wanted to be a spy.
Now, which one? Up. Roger Moore or
Sean Connery?
Sean Connery? Yeah.
He's the best. Son of a bitch. Smooth, man.
Very. I like Roger Moore, but I mean, I love Sean Connery, but I always, you know, I saw at my, you know, my age, I was watching Roger Moore in the movies. I was watching Sean Connery at home, so I think in the theater I kind of bonded more with Roger Moore.
Yeah, but you know, I always wanted to be a spy, but then my parents like pissed on the dream because they were like, "Chris, look, man, here's the reality of in the military, you know." Because I think they had a buddy who actually did it, and they were like, "Here's what this really entails. This isn't like, you know, just getting laid and, you know, being awesome and dressing nice, you know." So.
The James Bond would be your answer. I think that's a very good answer, actually.
Yeah, let's do James Bond, man. Let's stick with James
Bond.
Great,
you own James Bond. That's all you need. Who's had the biggest influence on your life so far?
Well, there's a couple of people. In the pit of my despair when my life exploded, which we really didn't go into detail about, and thank you, by the way. when I was about 27 years old, I had this intuition that I needed to call this guy, and his name is David Beavers. Mm-hmm. And he lives here in Nashville, and we were sort of involved in some of the same sort of circles.
Right.
And I just knew I needed to call David, and I was in the back of the house I owned at the time, and I called my buddy David. And
he's a musician in town also?
No, he's not a musician.
Okay.
No.
Just a buddy.
He's an older man. He's sort of my life mentor.
Cool.
He lives in a – it's kind of interesting. He lives in a like a really ritzy area of Nashville, like mm-hmm. old money. But he doesn't have old money. But his life exploded too at one point, and he built himself back up.
Right.
And so I would say – let's go with David Beavers. I want to say David Beavers. Shout out to David
Beavers. Shout out. Absolutely, man.
I love you, man. And you're the he's this guy in Bellmead, but he's the coolest guy I know. He's fascinated by music. And fun fact, his next door neighbor was but no longer is, but was for years, Chris Stapleton.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And he always found it interesting because Chris Stapleton lived in this area called Bellmead, which is a lot of old money and fine, refined old people. And you know, Chris Stapleton takes walks in knee-high jogger socks, you know. and David described him. He goes, he walks around, just looks like an old woolly booger.
Yeah, with that long beard, sure.
Yeah. So David has really talked me through some hard stuff.
That's good. It's good that you've been open to, you know, mentors and advisors. It sounds like, you know, because between Mike and David, it sounds like you got, you know, one or two other buddies.
We don't have enough time for me to tell you really all of them, but yeah, I'm completely open to that, and I've gained from it.
Yeah, that's great, man. I'm happy to hear that. One more question, man, before we go. Can you tell me one or two cool or bizarre or provocative stories or ridiculous stories from touring, and you don't need to name names?
Here's the thing, man, is that the short answer to that question is no, and let me tell you why. Because any story that happened on the road that's worth telling, I don't need to have that thing recorded. You know what I'm saying?
I hear you. That's fair. That's fair enough, man.
Please post that, or please keep this in the recording, because crazy stuff does happen. I'm not going to lie to you. And any story worth telling, man, it just don't need to be on record. Let's leave that where it landed.
That'll be on your – you'll put it on your social media account when you open one.
Yeah, sure.
Hey, man, I can't thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. Thank you for being so sincere and so transparent. Is there anything you'd like to promote, or is there anything you're working on right now that you want to let people know about, or can people see you online anywhere and find you out? Do you give lessons? I mean
– I think I want to promote Authentic Living. And then I would say, if you have any interest in my songwriting, you could find it on soundcloud.com/ – is it a backslash? Forward slash. Soundcloud.com/ Sir Charles and Friends Music. And, it's and Sir Charles, Charles
and Friends spelled out.
Sir Charles is yeah, Sir Charles, SirCharles and Friends Music. And Sir Charles is lying here on the dog bag next to me.
There you go.
Sir Charles McDougal. So, and, yeah, and that's whatever, where you can find the music.
For whatever it's worth, I checked out a number of the songs. There's some really good stuff. Who's singing on those?
Oh, yeah. That's my buddy Brian. That's my partner in crime, Brian Boss.
Got a great voice.
Yeah. He's actually got a YouTube family blog called Boss Life, B-O-S Life. And, yeah, man, he is probably one of, if not one or the most talented vocalists I've ever worked with. And I wrote most of those songs with him, and he is a genius, and I love him. And I'm about to go write a song with him in 37 minutes.
Let me give that website out. So check out Chris Hurst's stuff at soundcloud.com/ Sir Charles and Friends Music. That's Sir Charles, SirCharles AndFriends Music. Sir That's Charles correct. And Friends Music. Leave it to yes. Chris Hurst to pick out the longest possible URL in existence.
Well, you know what, man? I had to give credence to my best friend.
To your dog there, man. I mean, dogs are awesome. Dogs are
awesome. Order of the Queen's Knight, the second.
Hey, man, I had to put down one of my dogs 5 months ago, and I was bawling for weeks, and I still think about it every day. It's just terrible, dude, man.
When this dog leave, this dog has got me through hell. When he leaves this earth, just commit me.
It's tough, man. It was really – and then I had to put down my cats. It's been a tough year for animals in the Garber household. So, anyway, man, hey, listen, thank you so much. Again, you're a super cool guy, really transparent. You're a very good songwriter, and I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. Check out Chris's stuff on SoundCloud.com. Honestly, he's a very creative songwriter, some really cool stuff there. If you like stuff in the pop genre, pop country genre, really great melodies. I wish you nothing but luck, and I hope your single with April Cry gets released and played. And I'd love to have you back in another year or two to see what's going on with your life at that point in time, if you're open to that, man.
Yeah, man, of course I'm open.
Hey, thanks very much for listening. You can sign up to get notified of future episodes on our website at everyonelovesguitar.com. Now go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, I'm out. Peace. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.